their primary source of protein, and it is one of the least environmentally impactful proteins. The organization says it is a good idea to look for MSC-certified tuna caught in the USA and for sourcing or fishing method information on the package. I'm Terry D. reporting.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Anna Wilcox, Josh Salem, Dave Johnson, and Ken Jones. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Terry D., Danielle Smith, Antonio Gonzalez, and Simone Perez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our fall fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Ken Jones speaks with Gail Pasternak and Deborah Zaslow for their new book, The Rooster Princess and Other Tales, Jewish Stories, regarding populated with spunky heroines, wise women, brave crones, and powerful prophetesses. Stick around later. We'll have the winners of the Youth Creative Resilience Art Contest in studio to talk about their pieces.
Our in-depth guests today are Gail Pasternak and Deborah Zaslow, two of the editors for the new anthology, The Rooster Princess and Other Tales, Jewish Stories Repopulated, with spunky heroines, wise women, brave crones, and powerful prophetesses from Monkfish Press. Gail's a writer, storyteller, and educator, and an ordained Magida, or Jewish storyteller. She's a founding member of the Jewish Women's Storytelling Collective and serves on the board of directors of Willamette Writers here in Portland. Deborah was also ordained as a Magidah and travels nationwide telling stories. She's the author of the memoir Bringing Bubby Home and the audio collection Return Again, which features Jewish stories of healing. Deborah lives in Ashland and has taught at Southern Oregon University for 30 years. Gail and Deborah will be telling a few of the tales from the new book at Eastside Jewish Commons in Portland this Wednesday, September 17th. Deborah, the Jewish religion has a rich tradition of storytelling. The Hebrew term magid means narrator or preacher, and you and Gail are both magidah, which is the feminine form. What's the role of a magid or magidah?
Well, you know, the role of a magid or a magidah is the female has changed over the years. But in Eastern Europe, centuries ago, a magid was a kind of traveling teacher who would tell stories to illustrate points and was really a teacher of Torah and a storyteller. And the term nowadays has come to really mean a Jewish storyteller. But it also involves a lot of Torah learning. So in our Magid training program, my husband, who is a rabbi, and I do two parts of the training. I teach the storytelling and he teaches the Torah learning. to a group of about, we usually have about 10 or 12 students at a time.
Yeah, going back even further, I looked up Magid on Wikipedia, of course, where I kind of learn everything. It comes from Jewish mysticism and refers to a celestial entity, kind of like an angel, who delivers mystical secrets, sometimes speaking through the mouths of the chosen ones. So that's a lot of responsibility. So the stories you tell, even as a modern day Magidah, are not purely for entertainment. There's a spiritual or educational component.
Yeah, and the tradition of Jewish storytelling is associated with stories that are teaching stories. So they have wisdom, but they also have a lot of humor and they're very entertaining, but they are a way of teaching for sure.
Now, Gail, let's get to the new book, The Rooster Princess and Other Tales, which came out just last week. The subtitle is Jewish Stories Repopulated, with spunky heroines, wise women, brave crones, and powerful prophetesses. Those are all female figures, so it's a different take on the original stories.
Yes, we, in our Magid class, this was, I think, back in 2020, 2021, we were reading through a lot of the stories, and we started commenting on how few of the stories were about women. And sometimes, I mean, occasionally you might find a story about a really clever woman, but the holy point of the story was to prove that she was worthy of getting married. And in you know, in Jewish culture, women aren't like that.
No, definitely not. Deborah, in the book's introduction, you tell the story of how the book came about, and we have to give a lot of credit to your granddaughter.
Yeah, I was working with my granddaughter, and the pandemic had just started. So we were, she was 12, and we were working on storytelling, basically, because we needed, you know, to keep connected. And so I had her pick a Jewish story to tell. I gave her several examples and she picked one. And the first thing that I have students do when I've taught storytelling at the university here in Ashland for many years is make a storyboard. So they do a kind of, you know, stick figure sketch of the scenes in the story. And in order to do that, they have to visualize the characters. And I said to her, how do you visualize? Tell me how you visualize Elijah the prophet. This is a very common figure in Jewish storytelling. And she said, I see a woman. And I went, oh, because Elijah is, of course, a male character, Elijah the prophet. But in her imagination, which wasn't, she saw a woman. And I thought, well, why not?
And that's what we have with the book. So thank you to your granddaughter. Gail, you were introduced to several of these stories in their original form growing up in New York. Your family used to tell them around the dining room table. What did you love about hearing them? Was it the content, the way they were told, maybe a mix of both?
Oh, definitely a mix of both. Definitely a mix of both, yeah. And a lot of the stories actually that I heard around the table were personal stories, you know, stories of my ancestors living in Coney Island, my uncle, great uncle's experiences in World War II. And I heard some of these stories. I didn't start really getting into them when I came out here to Oregon. And I wanted to share Jewish culture with my children, but I didn't have an Aunt Sarah or an Uncle Marty who could tell stories of living in Coney Island and all of that. So what could I do? And so I started looking and I found a lot of these folk tales and stories. And we would read them around at the table every Friday night at Sabbath dinner. And it became a really important part of our family time together.
Now, putting a feminist spin on the tales, I was wondering, was that kind of a balancing act while doing justice to the traditional versions you and many of your readers heard as children? Was that a challenge in putting the stories together and kind of replacing some of the original male characters with women?
Well, in, for instance, in another story where there was a prophet-like figure, I substituted a character called Sarach Bat Asher, who is one of the characters, a female character that sort of lived forever like Elijah, but is very little known. And in replacing the characters, we didn't just replace characters. We changed the story to a more female-centered view. And we put in different female characters. We didn't necessarily just rename characters. And there's also, we put in some women, strong women in Torah stories, and we added in some personal stories. And there's several completely original modern stories that are Jewish stories, but about Jewish women, but they're not necessarily the traditional ones with just replaced female characters.
Now let's talk about some of your collaborators. You and Gail, Deborah, are listed as the new book's editors along with Deborah Rosenberg. But the author credit goes to, I think, 11 women in the Jewish Women's Storytelling Collective. Can you tell us about the collective, how it started and what they do? Obviously, they tell stories.
Well, we were all graduates of Magida, Deborah, and Rabbi David's training. And we're different. We're all storytellers, absolutely. Some of us actually work at synagogues, some work at schools, others just tell stories around town, like me. but we're all ordained Magida.
And Deborah, you're an ordained Magida and also train these women and other women to become Magida and tell these, and you yourself, you tell these stories and others across the country. I was just thinking there must be a certain power in that oral tradition, which has lasted thousands of years, telling the stories before a live audience that's different than reading them in a book.
I think storytelling is really different than reading from a book. And a lot of people, I think, in our culture today don't even know what storytelling is, because it's kind of a dying art. We know about reading stories. A lot of times if I say I'm a storyteller, people think that that means that I read stories to young children. Not really. Mostly my audiences are mixed or adult. Because my husband's a rabbi, I've been telling stories in synagogues, but we also travel around and do different kinds of storytelling programs. I've told stories in libraries. I've told stories in schools. I've told stories around campfires. There's a lot of venues, and it's quite different because it's a live art. I always say it's a contact sport. When you're telling stories, and you know, when you're reading a book, you're tied to the words in the book. When you tell stories, you don't memorize the words, but you're present with the audience, and you get a feeling, just like if you're speaking spontaneously, it's a back and forth. And so you feel the presence of the audience, and that alters how the shape of the story feels to you and then to the audience, back and forth going on.
And now, Gail, there's no better way to appreciate the power of these tales and the power of storytelling than to hear them for ourselves or a sample, given our time constraints. You very kindly agreed to treat us to one, and the story you picked is Hannah and the Moon, which is, of course, in the book.
Yes.
Would you tell that to us now? And we'll go into that story trance that Deborah talks about.
Deep in the heart of Eastern Europe, there was once a village called Chelm. Now, many considered it a village of fools, but the Chelmites knew they were wise, even if their wisdom looked different from everyone else's. Now, they were curious people who liked to ask scholarly questions, especially Hannah, the milkmaid. Hannah asked many questions. She couldn't help herself. Every day, she saw wondrous things that she needed to understand. One day, she got up early in the morning to milk her cows, and as she walked to the barn, her feet got wet from the dew on the grass. But later that day, when she delivered milk and cheese, the grass was dry. "Where does the dew come from?" she asked Freda, the woman who worked at the butcher shop. "And where does it go?" "It comes from the tears of the moon," Freda said. "One night, when it gets cold for the moon to warm itself, the moon gets sad and it cries. But during the day, when the sun gets too warm, it drinks up the dew to cool itself." Of course, Hannah thought. Freda was truly the wisest woman in the village. She went home that night and appreciated the cool of the moon. But the next day, she also loved the warmth of the sun. That afternoon, she asked Freda, "What is more important, the sun or the moon?" "The moon, of course," Freda said. "It shines at night when it's needed. The sun, pff, it shines only during the day when it's already light." Now, after that revelation, Hannah gazed up at the sky every night, and the more she did, the more baffled she became. The moon always changed, getting big and full one night and disappearing altogether several weeks later. And oh, those nights when it disappeared, so dark. Hannah often tripped over her neighbor's goat when she went out for a walk in the evening. Now, several weeks later, Hannah visited her cousin in another town, and when she took her evening stroll, she saw these poles with globes of light on top of them. They were like mini moons on every street corner. So when Hannah went back to Chelm, she convinced the elders to call a council meeting. And everyone in Chelm came. "Chelm needs these lamps on the street," Hannah said. "We do," Rachel the lacemaker said. And Freda agreed, so did Liba the water carrier. But the elders of Chelm scratched their chins and shook their heads. The wisest elder stood, "Where will we get the money for these lights on the street? We can't take it from the fund to feed the poor. We can't take it from our schools." And the Chelmites murmured in agreement. "We cannot afford these lamps," they all said. And Hannah thought, "I've got it. We'll steal the moon. Then we can use it whenever we need it." And she told them her plan.
And of course, that's just the first part. So we'll leave listeners with that cliffhanger, how do you steal the moon? Which is answered in the rest of the story. You know, I got to say, I was wondering, and wasn't on my list of questions to ask, was having read the story itself in the book and then hearing you, it makes me wonder, is there going to be an audiobook version of this too?
I think we're wondering the same thing. And it's a really good idea. And, you know, this is, for this collaboration of women, this is, well, it's not my first book, but for everybody else, most people it is. And we're not that experienced with making an audio book. So that's a new idea and something that we need to figure out how to do, you know, whether we have a publisher, Monkfish Publishing, who's doing the book, who's done the book now. And I don't know exactly how we would do an audio recording, but there's certainly lots of venues now.
Oh, well, I hope there is one. But Gail and Deborah, thanks so much for talking with us and wishing you a big mazel tov on the new book. We've been talking with Gail Pasternak and Deborah Zaslow, two of the editors for the new anthology, The Rooster, Princess, and Other Tales, Jewish Stories Repopulated, with spunky heroines, wise women, brave crones, and powerful prophetesses from Monkfish Press. They'll be telling some of those tales at Eastside Jewish Commons in Portland this Wednesday, September 17th at 7 p.m., and there are three more Portland area events planned in October: Monday, October 6th at Annie Bloom's Books, Tuesday, October 21st at Neva Shalom's Feldstein Library, and Saturday, October 25th at Bold Coffee and Books. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. We're joined in the studio today by Dr. Diane Kaufman, the founder of Hold On Campaign for Suicide Prevention and two of the winners of the recent Youth Create Resilience Art Contest, Sydney Chen and Finley Walls. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yay.
All right.
And Dr. Kaufman, let's get right into it. Would you tell us about the Create Resilience Contest?
Yes, of course. The Create Resilience Youth Art Contest asked Oregon youth ages 13 to 21 to share their ideas on how to improve youth mental health and prevent suicide. And the entries could be an essay, story, poem, visual artwork, anything creative. And we were funded by the Oregon Council for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and also Blick Art Materials donated some gift certificates as well. And I want to mention that the Create Resilience Youth Art Contest, which was originally named If My Words Could Make a Difference, began in 2020 when we received a grant from the Oregon Council. But as everyone might remember, as of March 2020, when we happened to receive that grant, COVID struck. So it is with great celebration that I say that we did it, the youth did it, and on September the 10th, which is World Suicide Prevention Day, we announced the winners of the contest, and it just shows you what passion and perseverance can do.
Wow. How did you judge the entries, and what did Sydney and Finley win?
Yeah. So there were three judges. Myself, I'm a poet, artist, internationally award-winning lyricist, and a retired child psychiatrist. And the other judges were poet Starlet Swan. Her Marble Me Free animated poem has won international awards. I was the director on that. And Lucia Martinez Rojas, who's a media design animator and artist. She was the animator of that film. And they were the judges. And the entries were judged on a number of criteria, some of which, but not limited to, were authenticity, originality, quality of artistic expression, and responding powerfully on how to improve youth mental health. And I want to say that all 20 of the youth who entered the contest are winners. They answered the call. And it takes, I think, vulnerability and a certain heart and mind and spirit to step up and enter such a contest. And I'm so proud of Sydney, who is sitting right next to me. Sydney won first prize. And that honor came with a $350 award.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
And how about second place?
And Finley was a tie for second prize. I want to say that initially there was going to be one person for second prize. Mm-hmm. But the entries were so excellent, I really felt we had to have a tie. So Finley won the tie for second prize. It was a $300 award. And the other second prize winner is Mahika Bon, who also won $300.
So, Sydney, would you tell me a little bit about what the thought process was? Why did you enter the contest?
I entered the contest because I currently volunteer for Oregon's Youth Crisis Line, Youthline. Shout out to Youthline. And I thought it was really important that I shared my personal experience about what made me want to join and what made me like deepen my interest in exploring youth mental health, especially because I want to be a child psychologist one day. And I think speaking about topics that are often stigmatized is one of the most powerful things we can do.
Now, your entry that won first place is a story. Would you share a little bit of the detail about your entry?
Yeah, so the story kind of starts with the current version of me meeting up for coffee with a younger version of myself. And originally, that's not what my idea started out as, but it was the best way I could think of like showing my dialogue and kind of my inner thought process, especially as a middle schooler, and kind of just having that like self-reflection there without it being too much telling and more so showing the audience of who I've become and how my experiences with mental health as a middle schooler have shaped me.
Finley, are you there? Finley?
Hello.
Hi, Finley. Hey, this Finley, there's same questions go to you, my friend. Why did you choose to enter the Create Resistance, rather Resilience contest?
I chose to enter mainly because I really love writing and like anything creative, and I'm very passionate about suicide prevention, because even though I'm not a like capital W writer, I like writing poetry. I write poetry and prose all the time. And oftentimes what I do write is very personal to me. So I felt that it would be very seamless for me to give an entry, especially about suicide prevention, because I have attempted suicide in the past. So I know firsthand how difficult it can be to deal with, and anything that can help prevent that is just a good thing to do.
Finley, please give me some more detail about your entry into the Create Resilience Youth Contest.
My entry is a poem. If I'm honest, the title is R.E. Hang In There, which was kind of tacked on at the end, but it feels thematically appropriate because the metaphor is about like the subject being held up by a rope. The ropes represent their loved ones in the poem. There is one loved one who lets them just hang in there by a little bit, and then there is no one, so they have to just like barely cling to the ledge. And then the part which represents the actual suicide attempt is when they attempt to let go of the ledge, but they are not allowed to, but because there are more ropes which hold on to them, which is more loved ones, and they eventually get pulled up by this because there are so many ropes, and that's the only way they could get pulled up.
And I'll stick with you, Finley. Kind of adding on what you were just talking about, tell me a little bit more about what you really wanted to say with your work of art.
Mainly that community can help people, because this ties a lot into specifically the mental health aspect, where people, especially people in America, can have a very individualistic, I don't need anybody mindset. But the people who have this kind of mindset are often the people who have the least amount of protection from harm that comes with having loved ones who are attuned into like everything that you do and can tell when you're having a terrible time, and also the least socialization, which is incredibly important for mental health.
Going back to you, Sydney, same question. What did you want to say with your piece of art?
I think having an understanding of who you are and what you want at a fundamental level, and especially looking back at past versions of yourself, even if, you know, it isn't something that you necessarily want to confront because of how much you struggled or because you weren't the best version of yourself, I think that's really important in just having a better understanding of not just yourself, but I think the world as a whole. Because the way you perceive yourself and how you navigate life, if you think, oh, I don't like anything I'm doing with my life, or my life has no meaning and no purpose, I think that kind of skews your perception of the world. And I try to portray that like in the conversation that I like had with my younger self in the story I wrote, and just showing how my changed perspective, having worked with youth that are like suicidal and have struggled with mental health in the past, how like having heard about those experiences and being able to share my own experiences and support people through those times when they need someone the most, how that can just be really crucial in shaping their day or even the course of their lives.
Wow. Dr. Kaufman, in creating a successful first-year program, what do you hope to accomplish going forward in 2026 and beyond?
Well, our goal is to extend the reach of the Create Resilience Art Contest to more of Oregon youth in 2026, and to make it into an annual contest. And I would love there to be Create Resilience Youth Ambassadors who can help spread the word, and also Create Resilience Champions who can help support financially and in other ways the program. And I really see the Create Resilience Resilience Youth Art Contest as becoming a model program that can be replicated across the United States. And I also want to add on a personal level that when I was in my mid-20s in medical school, I had attempted suicide. And I have a family member who died by suicide, friends who's died by suicide, two patients who died by suicide. So helping in any way that I can to bring the voices of youth out into the open is so important, because here in Oregon, suicide is the eighth leading cause of death, and it is the second leading cause of death for ages 15 to 34.
And the question we're very excited about, where can we see the art submissions by Sydney and Finley and the other participants?
Yeah. If you go to the Hold On Campaign website, www.holdoncampaign.org, go to the menu item Create Resilience, and on the drop down, you'll see 2025 Youth Art Contest winners.
Just want to say thank you so much, both of you, all three of you, for being here. Finley, Sydney, and Dr. Kaufman, thank you so much for the time. We've been speaking to our folks here, Dr. Diane Kaufman, the founder of Hold On, Campaign for Suicide Prevention, and two of the winners of the recent Youth Create Resilience Art Contest, Sydney Chen and Finley Walls. We've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. Stick around for Labor Radio up next.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements.